Andy Crome is my latest guest in this series of nostalgia interviews. Andy is senior lecturer in early modern history at Manchester Metropolitan University. He grew up in St Andrews and studied theology and ancient history at Lampeter. We talk about dialects, accents, early memories, the history of Lampeter, the people who embodied the place and gave it a sense of continuity. And we spent a lot of the time in the interview talking about Andy's work in early modern history and fandom and how it relates to Doctor Who and the crossovers between these areas. That's when Andy talks about Doctor Who episodes that are set in early modern history. I ask Andy whether he would fancy being a consultant for Doctor Who and whether there should be a Doctor Who musical. We talk about the mystique of the lost episodes. Andy also talks about the Starbucks appearance in Game of Thrones, whether that was accidental or not, and the potential for something to go wrong during live theatre performances. He talks about Manchester being a great city for live music, and we discuss what the artists think about what fans and academics are saying about them. And Andy indeed refers in this regard to what happened when Mark E. Smith of The Fall didn't think there was really all that much value in what academics were writing about his band. We find out how Andy entered academia and the guilt he feels around getting jobs that other academics haven't been successful in obtaining. And we discuss what it is to be an academic and the need to do several different things well. Andy discusses how not all of his memories are positive. He reflects on the sadness entailed in nostalgia around people that we have lost. In terms of whether we can be nostalgic about negative experiences, Andy talks about the desire for martyrdom in apocalyptic groups and about the fear of endings and how the history of apocalypticism has been about people who have been wrong in their predictions. And then in the final part of the interview, we learn what Andy wanted to be as a teenager, whether he'd be surprised to learn what he is doing now, which includes research on fandom in My Little Pony, as well as about how things once dismissed as geeky and embarrassing are now considered to be very much a normal part of popular culture. What an absolute privilege it was to meet Andy in his office in Manchester Met for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. It is such a pleasure to be at Manchester Metropolitan University with Andy Crome. Because we met once before, didn't we, Andy, at the Theology, Religion, Popular Culture Conference?
Yeah, back in 2015, I think.
Yeah, and we went, Leicester, wasn't it?
Leicester, yeah.
And it was great then, because I discovered that you were a Lampeter graduate, and you arrived at Lampeter in the, would have been the September, October, after I left. So between the two of us, we have like 13 years worth of Lampeter experience. I'm sure we'll come on to that. But how long have you been at Manchester Met?
I've been here since 2016.
Yeah. And you were at Manchester before that?
That's right. So I've been in Manchester for just about 13 years now.
Wow. Yeah. And where are you from originally?
I grew up in St Andrews in Scotland, despite my accent not really suggesting that at all. And then, obviously, down in Lampeter, I did a postdoc in Dublin for a year as well. So I've travelled around the British Isles a bit. Yeah.
No, and I have the same thing, because although I went to Lampeter in West Wales, I'm from Cardiff. I don't sound it. I know, exactly. And some people think that I'm originally from the Kent area, which happens to be where I'm working now. But I quite like that. So it's nice to sort of have that sort of air of mystery. You know, people don't, you know, people have to actually find out. Your accent doesn't give away. People have to do a bit of detective work.
Yeah, they have to actually ask you questions.
Yeah. No, that's right, because I've been going around Yorkshire and the north of England, and of course sometimes, you know, you see people on holiday who haven't travelled far for their holiday, so the line between holiday, you know, between tourist and resident is a blurred one. So yeah, it's nice to have that, you know, slightly more mysterious as a sort of side. So yeah, but tell me a bit then. So you from St Andrews, and what do you remember, Andy, from growing up? You know, what are your earliest memories?
Well, I should say, spent most of my childhood in St Andrews. I was born in London, and then lived in Surrey up until I was about seven. So I can remember bits and pieces, very early memories, I suppose, of living in London and just things like public transport, really, and the sheer number of people. My early schooling in the English system, I guess the way I remember that is sort of thinking about it in contrast to the Scottish system, and even having only had sort of 2 years of schooling in England, being very aware of the differences when you get to Scotland, and very aware particularly of differences in dialect and accent and teaching strategies as well. So in terms of sort of early memories, I guess that's it, and normal stuff of a home life and my parents and my sister and
And what did your parents do? So a very different path to what you're doing.
Yeah, in a way. So my dad works in hospitality, and he's worked in some very high-end hotels. So it's quite interesting seeing the sort of juxtaposition of the kind of people he would and the kind of circles he'd move in at work, and the kind of people he'd be working for, and then his home life, I suppose, and him trying to sort of juggle a persona, I suppose, that you develop in the hospitality industry, and a genuine sense of self, which I think I sort of became increasingly aware of as I got older. My mum was a housewife. She used to be a teacher, and when she had me, she gave up teaching and she did bits and pieces, sort of charity volunteering and stuff. Yeah. While we were growing up.
Yeah, no, my mum didn't work after... Well, my sister's older than me by 3 years, so she didn't work after that. But my dad worked on the railways for 48 years. Wow. Although so completely different to what I'm doing. When I saw my parents at the start of my travels here this week, it struck me in a way that there is a lot of... You know, there's something about the attitude to work that, you know, he may not have gone through the university system in the way that I have... Nevertheless, the sort of way of dealing with particular people, you know, in a sort of employment context or, you know, staff context, you know, over the years, the same sort of patterns emerge. And of course, also when you've been in a place long enough, people start to rely on you as the person who sort of knows the answer to X, Y, Z. Because I remember being for the first 2 or 3 years at Kent, I was very much the new person. And then suddenly there was a point when it's when people arrive after you and then leave while you're still there. And then you start to realise that you are starting to become part of the furniture.
Which is a good thing, yeah. Right?
But of course at Lampeter, you would have been taught by some of the same people that I was, who'd been, you know, in Paul Badham and others, who'd been there since the 70s. And some staff had been there even earlier than that. So you would have been very much aware of the history of the college.
Yeah, I think my impression of Lampeter was that you couldn't really avoid that that sense of history. Yeah. And not just the fact in terms of staff who'd been there for a long time, but the nature of the buildings and the appeals to tradition, I think, as well, which I mean, probably more the case when I was going there than when you were starting out. They were making a much bigger thing of the history, because I think there was more of a sense of competition from the post-92 universities and this fear almost that they'd be seen as this new player and sort of just a university that we'd plonked in the middle of nowhere. Mm. So trying to establish that, or trying to emphasise that sense of tradition, I think, was really important in their recruitment strategy when I was going around open days and such like. But having people who had worked there for so long, I mean, I was thinking of Nigel Yates in particular, who was just fantastic, and that sense of core of people like Badham and like Yates, who were in the theology department, who just seemed to embody the place and have and give you a sense of continuity stretching back. That it was something which you really, I think, it helped the identity. It helped you feel part of something. And,
yeah, and also in a place as well, because the place might change and generations come and go, but I think having that kind of kernel in place, that sort of almost a sense that they are part of the infrastructure and they're known for their research, that in a way that they've put Lampeter on the map. I agree that was important. But your degree was in theology, was it as well?
Yeah, theology and ancient history.
Yeah.
So it was quite nice to have a combination of those two and to see the differences in the departments.
Because I sense now, of course, that although obviously it's early modern history is your area, but of course I also know you in a very different capacity through your research with the work on fandom, for example, and implicit religion and Doctor Who.
That's right. So I have these two sides to my work, which I try and keep going. As much as I focus, obviously, on the historical side as my main research, I I like to keep the popular culture, religion stuff ticking over.
Yeah.
So I got into that through writing about Doctor Who and religion, which has been a great topic to write on. And you meet so many interesting people who have sort of some experience of faith and some experience of the show and the fandom, and want to bring those two together. And I mean, I should say that a lot of the people who've written about this also don't have any particular faith, but they're interested in religious themes. And I think you find this with science fiction fans in particular, that they're used to thinking about big ideas. They're used to trying to think in terms of world building and how beliefs fit into that and how they influence actions and how that makes logical sense. It's not too surprising that those sort of people are interested in how religion and the role religion plays in fictional societies, and sort of extrapolating outwards in that and engaging in the philosophical and theological elements of it.
No, because what's brilliant about what you do is that because you have quite discrete research, teaching areas, it also means that you've got the sort of the ballast in place. Because the danger, I find it with students taking my religion and film course, sometimes they might not be doing religious studies, but they're interested in film, or they might be doing religious studies, but just sort of think, well, you know, they have a passion for film, which then they struggle with a little bit, because they find that some of the theology that I bring into the module is a bit alien to them. But those who've done courses with me or other colleagues that are more theologically based, you know, have got the infrastructure. So I think the danger is that someone is a big safe Whovian, you know, a fan of Doctor Who, and then does research on it. But there needs to be some kind of disciplinary anchor. It doesn't matter which one. It could be implicit religion, but something that makes that fit together. Otherwise you just feel that, you know, you're effectively saying, well, I love Doctor Who, so you don't know what do you write on? You talk about the content of the episodes, do you talk about the science fiction behind it? You know, so you need to have some infrastructure in place. But do you find that, I'm assuming that there isn't an obvious crossover between the two areas, or do you find that in terms of methodology they do work together, or is it just that one's a good sort of counterpoint to the other?
I do find areas where they cross over, actually, because my historical research has been mainly on history of apocalypticism. So in terms of the point of crossover, I've just done an article actually thinking about approaches that are drawn from the study of fan fiction and how we can use those to understand early modern prophecy. So particularly looking at how characters are used from the biblical narrative, how they're reimagined.
Yeah.
How there are disputes about the ownership of these characters between different prophets, and these sort of play out on a literary field at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. So I think there are crossovers, definitely there, and there are crossovers as well in terms of understanding how groups of people become passionate about things. And now saying that, there's always a danger that you're trying to find some kind of justification for your work, and you're using all this arbitrary reasoning and say, well, it's okay because I can make this apply to history, so give me some money to research it or whatever. I try to be on my guard against that and try not to see connections which are perhaps a little bit forced just for the sake of them being there. But I don't know, I'm sure my work is open to the challenge that I do that.
No, but it's interesting you say that, because that was one of my biggest fears in the theology and film work about Christ figures, and finding Christ figures in all sorts of unexpected places. So I actually wrote an article once about about stretching the elastic too much. But in your case, have you literally found sometimes that a Doctor Who, I think maybe we were talking about this actually at that conference in 2015, but have you ever sort of found that there's a Doctor Who episode, or maybe your dream Doctor Who episode, where Doctor Who has gone to the very location or the very sort of era that you're studying as part of the other part of your research, which would be the most wonderful holistic coming together? Or alternatively, of course, you could write that screenplay.
It has happened. There have been Doctor Who episodes set in early modern history, sort of unsurprisingly, given how obsessed we are with it in popular culture, particularly Tudor history. But there's an episode last year, actually, about James I and Sixth of Scotland and witch hunting, which was not super historically accurate, but was interesting nonetheless. certainly the doctors visited the English Civil Wars and early 18th century, St. Bartholomew Day Massacre, which was a really interesting early episode because that was produced in the 60s when they were still producing straight up historical episodes. So you don't have any aliens, you don't have anything supernatural at all. It is just they're experiencing religious persecution in France in the 16th century, which of course you wouldn't get today. I don't think the audience would be particularly interested in it, and certainly they wouldn't understand the differences that you find between Protestants and Catholics and why these people are disagreeing so vehemently. Whereas in the 60s, it's presumed the audience will actually have some grasp of this history. They will understand these differences and be able to actually apply that to the episode. So it's interesting when you're tracing a show like Doctor Who and you're tracing audience responses to it and thinking about religion, or thinking, in fact, about history as well, and historical education. Looking at what's presumed to the audience in different periods and what is acceptable to bring to that audience.
Yeah. No, and do you also find then that they do draw accurately on historical sources, or is there an academic, someone like yourself, who they sort of go to make sure that there's a certain sense of accuracy or authenticity in what they're presenting? Or do you think that's something that you could see yourself doing perhaps in the future?
Well, I mean, I would love to have some kind of consultation role on television programmes, but in terms of Doctor Who, the writers will go and they will do historical research. There's no question about that. But I tend to be sort of quite relaxed about the accuracy of some of these things, quite simply because you're never going to get a completely historically accurate adaptation, because no matter how focused you are on accuracy, you're not there to produce a documentary or an academic text. In fact, you're there to produce something that entertains. And at the end of the day, the key point has to be the plot.
Yeah.
It can't be the minutiae of historical accuracy. So when you see, I think it was Howard's End, actually, the adaptation that was done in 2017.
Mm.
There was the Daily Mail made a big fuss about the way people were eating marmalade with their breakfast, that they wouldn't have used these spoons. Yeah. They would have. This was against etiquette, and they sort of claimed all these historians were deeply angered about this. And I mean, what they'd done is they'd phoned up a historian and they'd said, are there any historical inaccuracies? Please watch the episode and tell us them. And then sort of built up this whole story. But those inaccuracies, they don't have any impact on the plot. And 99.9% of viewers aren't going to notice or aren't going to care about those. Yeah. So particularly if you're thinking of science fiction, where you are introducing some kind of supernatural element or alien element or time travel element, you're always going to have something which doesn't quite fit in.
Yeah, and of course some people go to town, it's almost like an industry around looking for those goofs, looking for those mistakes. I mean, you know, there were the obvious ones sometimes in 70s or 80s costume dramas where somebody would be wearing a Rolex watch and it was sort of set in, you know, 1750 or something.
Well, right,
like that.
The Starbucks cup in Game of Thrones.
Oh, really? Was that deliberate, do you think?
I don't think it was. I think they played it very well, but if you think of the budget of Game of Thrones and the number of people who watch those edits, and then if something can creep through like that, an unintentional anachronism is always going to work its way in.
But it's like going to a play, though, isn't it? I remember when I went to see The Mousetrap in London, and there was something when the phone rang and the person answered it, but the phone continued to ring or something. And I did wonder afterwards whether that was intentional to make the audience think that something had gone slightly wrong. And I don't know, I have no reason for thinking that, because I've only seen it once. But if I saw it a second time, you know, then I'd probably, or maybe they move it around. Because if you know, they're doing the same show every day, I guess sometimes just to keep themselves on their toes. Or maybe it just was a mistake. But as I was watching it, you know, you're thinking, it's such a polished act. You're almost like waiting for something to go wrong, but then something does go wrong, but you think, but it's them really saying, no, we are we actually really are. It almost like reinforces then the everyone's on the edge of their seat, and it added to the excitement. I would say actually, you sort of you pay more attention to the performance because there's always that sense because it's a live show in a way that a film isn't. You know that that something could go wrong, and that's you know you're there, you're paying all this money not to, to watch something on screen that, that was made many years earlier, but actually watch it that's playing out live in front of you.
Yeah, and I think that remains part of the appeal of live theatre or any kind of live performance. The potential that anything can happen at any moment and something could go wrong. And the seeing the reactions of actors to that when things have gone slightly wrong is always very interesting.
Yeah.
I've got a good friend who's involved in sort of various improvisation troupes at quite a high level, and I'm always intrigued by the process that you go through there, that you genuinely have no idea what's going to happen when you go on stage. And you're constantly reacting to the audience and to other people, and there's no safety net of a script, there's no safety net of any kind of guidance. It's just about chemistry and just about having confidence in what you're doing.
So do you think there should then be a Doctor Who the musical?
I don't know. It worked for Buffy, so...
I didn't know that, yeah.
Yeah, well, there was a great episode of Buffy, which was a musical episode.
Okay, yeah.
And that worked, but I think it works as a novelty. I'm not sure.
But on the stage in the West End?
Well, there were Doctor Who live plays in the 70s and 80s, and... Yeah, I mean, I would go and see it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and actually, but I never got... I mean, a lot of people when I was at Lampeter, actually, in the early 90s, were really into Doctor Who. There was a Doctor Who society which I joined. But I joined it, in a way, without knowing, obviously, preempting my present research in nostalgia. But I watched it because I used to enjoy those. Because I remember Tom Baker as Doctor Who. I've interviewed some people as part of this podcast series who remember the first ever Doctor Who. Two of the people I've interviewed remember the first ever 1963 William Hartnell episode. The same week as John Kennedy was assassinated, so you know. So of course, then the talking about that as well. But I remember Tom Baker. But it's always very exciting when they'd have those episodes when then it was the three Doctors, then it was the five Doctors. I think, although Tom Baker didn't want to be part of it. So, but then they had to then add that into the script and somehow using old images of him with Romana on a boat or something, and they were locked in some vortex, and then the other Doctors had to try and get him out. Of course, at the end of the day, it's just because he didn't want to be in it or wasn't available to be in it, but so they actually made the rest of the script around that conceit,
which was, I mean, it's faintly ridiculous in the episode itself, but that episode, I guess, is interesting from a nostalgia point of view because, of course, Hartnell was dead, so it's played by a different actor as well. So you only really have three of the Doctors, and that was, 1983, so it's before the VHSs had come out. So for the vast majority of the audience, a lot of them would never have seen a Hartnell or a Troughton episode.
That's right.
So they wouldn't have quite the same nostalgic connection to the Doctor. Yeah. And I, for me, because I got into Doctor Who as a kid, when did I discover it? So I must have been 8 or 9, so very early 90s. And I didn't have a lot of access to the videos. We didn't have Sky, so we weren't watching any repeats. So a lot of my discovery of the show was through the Target book range, and my impressions of these Doctors were all formed, or a lot of the time formed through the text rather than the actual shows themselves, which I suppose from a special effects point of view was quite good, because in your head you're not dealing with the somewhat... low budget effects and such like.
Yeah, but I'm guessing now that I'm guessing it's possible to get access to all or many of the old episodes.
Yeah,
everything
that the BBC hasn't lost, and even many of the lost episodes.
Yeah.
Most of the lost episodes have audio recordings, and a number of them have been animated now as well.
Yeah. And does that add to the mystique, though? I mean, these days it is so easy. If you want something, just on your computer, you can find it. But in those days, you know, there was always that sense of having to make that trek, that pilgrimage, going around old secondhand bookshops or record stores, looking for copies of out of print VHS, films or books. And there was something exciting about that, that there was a challenge. You'd say, well, I'm looking for this. And if you found it, it was like, you know, finding the, not the Lost Ark, you know, whatever Indiana Jones, you know, goes after. I think in that sense that, although it's great from a research point of view that you can find everything that you want, from a personal point of view, it's almost as though that without that pilgrimage angle, the ritual angle involved in finding those lost episodes, I'm wondering if some of the magic has been lost. I don't know if that's something that you've thought about.
I think it's definitely a feeling among some older fans that some younger fans of Doctor Who or Star Trek or whatever, if you can just go on Netflix and stream the whole thing, you don't have this sense of really having to search out these episodes and really taking the effort. And I mean, there's a difference, of course, between what fans were doing in the late 80s or early 90s, coming together to watch episodes, which, of course, were increasingly available on VHS at that point, though super expensive. And you couldn't, if you wanted some of the Hartnells, for example, you would often have to buy one video at £20 to get the first five parts and then buy another one at the same price. Yeah. So in terms of inflation, you're probably talking about £80 in today's money for two videos. But the lost episodes are something different because these are episodes that the BBC scrapped. They thought there was no value in keeping these. They needed the tape. They needed the archive space. So they wiped them or they just threw them away. So where these things were turning up was in foreign TV stations where they'd been sent. If someone had happened who'd worked on the show to take something home and bunged it in the attic and forgotten about it. So the lost episodes have a whole different mystique. So there is this sense that younger fans sort of don't know they've been born because they have access to everything so easily, and of course they've got the internet, so you don't have necessarily quite the same fan culture where people are coming together at conventions and people have this physical community around them. But you've also got the mystique of the lost episodes. Can we find these sort of holy grails which may be out there in some obscure television archive in Nigeria or Hong Kong? And of course, the odds are that they aren't out there anymore just because people have been actively looking for these things for 30 years plus now. And they're worth a lot of money if you find them. But there are episodes which have turned up quite randomly.
And it's funny because it applies to radio programmes as well. How these days, everything, I mean, you can, through box of broadcasts, access anything that the BBC has, certainly radio programmes from, I think, 2007 onwards. But if there's stuff that I listened to in the 80s or the 90s growing up, it's very, you know, that it's only if somebody had recorded it and kept it and digitised it that it's available. And sometimes, you know, I belong to a few online sites, Retro Radio is one of them, sites where people will often put up old programmes or they happen to record. But of course, at the time, if you missed the programme, that was it. Of course, these days, we've got the BBC Sound app. You can catch up on those missed recordings. But in those days, you know, if you wanted to know what was happening in the news, yes, there was teletext. Or we'd all, as a family, sit around the TV and watch the 6 o'clock news. You know, these days, I'd be on my app and, you know, I could be sitting in a library somewhere or having a coffee or I could be in bed. And, you know, there'd be an alert to say there's some, you know, latest, some breaking news thing. And again, it's better in some ways, but it takes away some of that community and ritual sort of dimension that I very much associate with growing up.
Yeah, and I mean, having said that, I'm struggling to think the last time I sat down to watch the news because you've always got 24-hour news channels, or as you say, the apps as well.
And you can pick and choose what you watch in that sense as well. So you only watch the, you know, if you're not interested in business news, well, you can disregard that and just focus on what interests you, which is perhaps pluses and minuses, because we sort of just have our niche interests almost then corroborated by this approach.
But while I'm saying that there's sort of this sense in fandom that that things are much easier to find, there's a lot in fan culture which hasn't changed. So conventions are different, but conventions still go on. Local meetups still go on. I think it's, as with everything, it's been changed by new technology, and it's vastly expanded as well.
And what about music? Because I think, but back to that conference in 2015, I think you knew what was number one in the charts when you were born. And if I'm right, it's also, maybe we should clarify that first. Am I right in thinking
Men at Work Down Under?
Because I was interviewing our Vice Chancellor at Kent, who said that was the first record she ever bought.
Oh, wow.
So, and I thought of you. So this is that game, is it 3 degrees of Kevin Bacon or whatever number it is, and everyone's connected to somebody in some way. So that was number one when you were born. That was the first record she bought. And it's incredible sometimes how, you know, we from different places, from different times, music can unite people. Obviously, the same happens with Doctor Who. But do you have particular... Obviously, you don't remember Men at Work from the period, but do you have any sort of particular memories of the charts or growing up with music as a teenager, for example?
Yeah, I mean, it was very much when I was a teenager, sort of the Britpop era, Oasis and Blur, and the Battle of the Bands was kind of the big media thing. Mm. And I mean, I listened to quite a lot of that. I mean, I really got into music, I suppose, probably... in terms of other than sort of the chart bands in sort of 96, 97, so when I was sort of 14, 15, I was quite into a lot of the Welsh bands, so Catatonia I really liked, and that led me to discover all kinds of sort of weird smaller Welsh bands. There's one called Big Leaves who I still listen to. Mm. Actually, they only released two albums, but they were just and they sang a lot in Welsh as well. So I mean, that was probably part of the attraction to Lampeter, that this kind of romanticism to do with Wales related to the music.
And did you ever see them live, or any other of those artists live?
I never saw. Well, I saw the Manic Street Preachers live, actually, but I didn't see live music really until I was 18. I think the first gig I went to was Bon Jovi, actually, at Hampden Park.
Good heavens.
Which, yeah, I know.
Yeah, that's on the scale, you know, as scale goes, you know, that's pretty hard to beat, I would imagine.
So yeah, that was a good first experience, I think. But obviously that's a lot later than a lot of people.
Yeah. And where were you in relation? Were you? Did you have a good view? Did you manage to see them, or were you all the way at the back?
No, we had quite a good view, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And then from then on, I sort of had more opportunity to see live music.
Yeah.
Not so much in Lampeter, I have to say, other than local bands.
Mm.
But certainly when I graduated, and particularly when I moved to Manchester, I tried to see basically as much live music as I could.
Yeah.
I don't see quite as much these days, but I think there's something about seeing bands live which is... which is still very, very special. There's a real energy there.
Mm. No, that's interesting, actually, because around the time I was doing my A-levels and went to university, the Manchester scene was huge. So it was the Happy Mondays and, I guess, Blur and Oasis. That was a few years later. But certainly around... Was it Primal Scream? I don't know. No, Pearl Jam.
They were Glasgow, weren't they?
Yeah, but there was another
New Order.
But it was huge. You know, it was almost as
though Stone Roses.
That was the one. Fool's Gold, and that was huge. You know, sort of early 90s, and there were some people who said they were going to. Well, I know what it was. A friend of mine had applied to Manchester to do his degree, but didn't get a place, and he found out that the reason was that because of the Manchester music scene, applications to Manchester to do, you know, unrelated subjects had, you know, gone through the roof, and therefore they had had to turn people away. I don't know whether that anecdotal, that I remember hearing that, but you know, and I think a lot of people then were quite surprised that I was choosing to go somewhere in very much the other direction, and yet I had this sort of love of music, not really live music. I'd never been to any gigs at that age, but it's interesting sort of the way in which we do things often, you know, back to front. But it sounds like you did it all. Yeah,
and I mean, being in Manchester, it is a great city for live music, because most of the bands do come through here, and there's such a range of venue sizes as well.
No, and one of my friends who I interviewed last summer in Glasgow is a music journalist, and you know, just the other, I think yesterday she went to see Ian McCulloch, you know, Echo and the Bunnymen.
Yeah.
And a few weeks, literally a week ago, she saw the Human League, and I'm like, hang on, you know, I'm missing something. Do they, you know, whatever ship passes through there, you know, is missed the Port of Dover. I'm, you know, but then again, London's just up the road. And actually, just something else, just in a way unrelated, just about Doctor Who. I was thinking, what would William Hartnell think about all this? You know, because obviously he couldn't have known it was a job for him. He was in one of the first Carry On film. But you know, you wonder, don't you? Sort of what the same applies to music artists as well. You know, sometimes when the fans like their music or their the shows that they're in, perhaps more than they do, or that, you know, for them it's a job, it's money for the, you know, for their families or for their, you know, to help their careers, and you know, from other people it's life and death, and literally in your case with the research on apocalypticism, end of the world scenarios, you know, so do you ever find that sort of disparity?
Well, you see it. I mean, if you go to any convention, I think you're always going to see that to some extent when you have the actors out. There are some. And I wouldn't say most, I would say actually in the minority, there are some who will view going to the convention as something which is basically very arduous, but they get paid very well for it, so they will do it because it's a job. They were in, it's the famous Saturday Night Live sketch that William Shatner did, the Get a Life one. Yeah. I was in this, and I mean, he's obviously playing up to his own persona there, but I was in this show. Yeah. 20 years ago, it was just a job, etc. Most actors, I think, and most people who've been involved in that, when they see what it means to people, they see the convention circuit, and it's a steady stream of money. And if you're an actor, having a steady stream of money is obviously something quite positive. But B, you're being invited into these spaces where people have a lot of affection for you, a lot of affection for your work, have often discovered your other work through Doctor Who or Star Trek or whatever it is you've done, and then they relay that to you. So there's usually a lot of giving back and a lot of acknowledgement that this is something, okay, you didn't expect it at the time. It was just another job, but it's become something more, and it's become a legacy, even if it's an unintended legacy.
Yeah, and that can often be the problem when you, as the saying goes, you know, don't meet your heroes, because I've been in that situation when sometimes you meet a filmmaker and you want to say to them how much their work means to you, and they sort of give you this funny look like, you know, why are you telling me this? And it's like, oh, you realise that, you know, they either are too modest to think that through, or they just feel uncomfortable that somebody is. So it's the equivalent of, I suppose, it's not likely to happen in our profession so much, but it, you know, you could be in the supermarket or somewhere and somebody wants to start talking about the book that you wrote or something like that, and you know, it's fine, but sometimes you just feel a bit like, I don't know how to respond to this, but you know, sometimes it is very hard if somebody has produced something which has impacted on you heavily to the point that you undertake, you know, 3 or 4 years of your life is under, you know, is spent researching that phenomenon, and, you know, then in a way you kind of hope that there's going to be some kind of reciprocity and that ultimately they might even read your work.
Well, I think that's unlikely.
Yeah, that's the thing. But it's not, almost to feel, of doing all of this, you want them to sort of feel, wow, you've got it. That's exactly what I was thinking of. That was what motivated me to work on this, you know. But you've almost sort of like given me the categories in order for that to be, to, you know, to make sense.
Yeah, and I think when we're doing academic work on popular culture as well, it can be quite hard to communicate. I think there was a conference on just getting the name of the punk band right, the Fall. Marky Smith. An academic conference at the University of Salford a few years ago, and he basically said, oh, this is a load of shit, this whole thing. Why are academics analysing our work? My lyrics is. There's no value in doing this. It's against the whole spirit of what I'm trying to do. So I can see sometimes if if you're an artist or even an actor or a showrunner, having academics come in and analyse something can seem counterintuitive in a way, and you can be quite defensive about that and perhaps misunderstanding what you're trying to do. But I think particularly where fans are concerned, if you have people who want to engage with your work in a positive way, and it has to be said, not all fans do want to engage with your work in a positive way. Some of them want to ask you why you've messed up their favourite show or whatever.
Yeah.
But you're going to respond positively to that. To that positivity from the fans as well.
And sometimes all that you want is a conversation or to be heard. That's the thing, you know, respectful disagreement. I mean, often my students, I'm sure you have the same, sometimes they're a little bit apprehensive. They feel that if they're going to say something that's different from what you've written, for example, that, you know, I suppose they may worry you might give them a low mark, but they're also just worried that they're offending you. And it's like, well, no, you know, that's the whole point. You know, if your job is just to regurgitate what I said, then there's no, you know, you might as well just literally copy the book out word for word. There's no point being in classes.
And I think that's so hard to communicate to a lot of students, that it is okay to disagree with you. It is, if you can back up your point and it's not the point I feel, or it's not what I've written, then go with it.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking of a convention I was recently at where a fan was talking to someone who had previously been the showrunner on a show, and she was presenting her vision for what she would have done, but she said, look, this isn't my show anymore. I wouldn't. The fact that I would have done it this way doesn't mean that necessarily I disagree with what was done. The people who are in charge of it are still very talented, creative people, so we can disagree on the paths that particular characters and storylines have taken without necessarily doing down other people's work.
Yeah. And how did you end up in academia? So what was the path that led you to doing what you're doing now?
Really, it was... I guess I've been lucky, I would say, because I think you need to have a fair degree of luck to get an academic job. And I've tended to be in the right place at the right time. So if I were a 17th century Calvinist, I would say Providence. But I worked for a couple of years doing sort of fairly uninteresting jobs once I'd finished my degree, and then I came back for postgraduate study. I was doing a research master's at Manchester University and was very lucky to work with Graham Ward, who's just a fantastic mentor and just all round, I don't think he'd like the term genius, but he's one of these people who knows everything about everything, or seemingly you can talk to him about anything at all. And he encouraged me to go for the PhD, which I did, and then I basically did part-time teaching for a year, worked in a bank in Stockport as well, and I got a non-academic job working for a marketing company, actually, which would have been very interesting, but I had, at the same time, I was offered a 0.5 part-time contract for 10 months of lecturing, and I sort of had to weigh up the job security with the potential that I could remain in academia for another year. And very much against my better judgment, I decided to remain in academia. And from then on, I was lucky enough to get a postdoc. Then a job came up at the right time at Manchester, which was full-time, and then this job, which was permanent at Manchester Met, I got in 2016. So I'm under no illusion. I know people who are far better academics than I am who haven't had that luck. I think it makes you feel a bit guilty, really.
There's two things. One of them is imposter syndrome. People think, I have no right to be here. The other, there's also a lot of luck involved, but you know, it's circumstances around family, about being able to move, how far you can travel, financial circumstances. Because you know, I've known of you know, some academic jobs where 100 people have applied, and presumably all 100 of those have PhDs or, you know, meet the criteria, but only 4 or 5 of those are going to be shortlisted.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that regard, you know, getting in is a lot harder. But at the same time, for us, you know, it's often deemed to be very vocational. But it's what you put into it, I guess, as well. And in some respects, there's, you know, it's interesting what you just said about being, you know, what it is about being a good academic. Because in many, you know, from a student's point of view, they may not care so much about the number of books you have, but about, you know, how good you are at communicating, or whether you mark the essays in a timely fashion, and whether you're approachable and a good pastoral person in a student support, senior tutor type context. And in other respects, of course, it might be that, you know, having one of those administrative jobs, being a having a headship or leadership role is important. And the research, you know, for some people is the only reason that they're in the profession. So, you know, there's these different hats that we all have to wear. But if you can wear all of those hats to varying degrees at different times, sometimes you have to wear them at the same time, you know, then in that respect, I guess you probably have, and if you stay the course, then you must be doing something right.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I do think you're right. And it's about trying to do all those things well. And I think I've been very lucky with the colleagues I've worked with as well, that I've seen good practice. And I've been lucky enough to work in departments where people don't hate each other and have always been supportive. So that's really helpful as well. I think that that makes a big difference. I mean, in terms of research, obviously that's a big part of what I do, and I enjoy that. But I think you're right. I think the vast majority of students don't look at our research unless it's directly related to an essay that they're writing.
And you're right, you know, the old expression, you know, no man is an island. But of course, there are certain things you can do. You can, you know, the research can be, well, I suppose you're still dependent on other sources that other people have done, but, you know, it's your research. But at the same time, there's a lot of things that you can't do except as part of a team. And if you're part of that community and you ensure that community is a vibrant one, then you know, you also have a better quality of life as well, I think, that you enjoy what you do rather than sort of feel it as an add-on. You know, I just want to write books all day. Get grant applications, you know, very important though they are. Yeah. So some more sort of philosophically based questions to round off, Andy. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones in your, you know, ooh, the whole, as you survey the whole of your life?
That's kind of a difficult question to answer. I don't know if I'd say predominantly. I've got a lot of positive memories. I had a happy home life as a child. I think a lot of, particularly when you talk about nostalgia, to me, there is a kind of sadness there with that, in terms of things you've lost and people you've lost. Yeah, I don't know if I would say my memories are predominantly positive.
There's that related question about, well, I suppose, you know, the word bittersweet comes up in the context of nostalgia, but whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. Because in a way, that was the impetus for this project to an extent, that there's this sort of sense of, you know, the golden age, the grass is always greener on the other side, it was better in 1992 than it, you know, or whatever it might be. And sometimes so, and sometimes that could be corroborated by diaries. You mentioned earlier about Howards End, and, you know, whether that they were using forks that existed at the time that Forster was writing or whatever. But of course, it also applies in the sense of today, that, you know, I don't necessarily remember what I used and what I did 25 years ago in my own lifetime, but often you sort of get an innate sense that a particular period was a happy one, or, you know, some years, I think, the sun was shining that year, or the rain, it was rainy in that year. And often it's not just to do with the meteorology, it's often to do with mindset. So in a sense, do you think that it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences, or are we, you know, do we have this innate need to try and gloss over some of those more unpleasant memories? You know, do we have this need for there to be a happy ending ultimately?
I think that's a really interesting question. I would say it's possible to be nostalgic for negative experiences. Sometimes I think, and I'm just thinking about the apocalyptic angle here, that there is a nostalgia in certain apocalyptic groups, and a desire for persecution, for example, a desire for martyrdom, because that shows that you have been chosen. So, of course, when this is negative experience, it's negative from bodily point of view, but of course it shows that you are truly one of God's chosen people. So there's almost a sense, particularly in Western apocalyptic groups today, when they're writing about Christian persecution, there's almost a sense of nostalgia for a persecution which existed in the early church and which they claim is coming back.
Yeah.
And then you sort of, or my question would be, well, is somebody laughing at you or not wearing a cross at work or whatever, is that quite the same as, say, the persecution which does go on in the world today, where people are being killed for their faith?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, that's a whole, that's my own personal view. But there is that nostalgia for perhaps things to get worse before they get better.
No, I also remember Paul Badham and one of his articles on death and immortality, and he wrote, it was Saint Ignatius of Lyon, and how I long for the lions, and that sort of notion of, you know, if you think that you're going to some blessed afterlife, then actually you want to be mauled by the lions in the amphitheatre, because, you know, that will get you to your destination quickly. You know, but, and again, it's the gloss on that, because that wouldn't be everybody's apprehension. Of course, the same argument about suicide bombing. You know, so it's sort of, we have very different perceptions sometimes about, you know, if we, and also some people don't have that same certainty of goal. The idea that they know what's going to happen, and therefore it's going to happen so absolutely that if you can short circuit that process, that therefore that's a good way forward. A lot of people would find that it's about process, and you don't try and circumvent the end.
No. And I think, yeah, circumventing the end is often, there's often a feeling that that's totally counterproductive as well.
Yeah.
Is there a desire for happy endings? I think there always is a desire for happy endings, but there's a fear of endings as well, because I guess we come back with the Book of Revelation. It's always the question, is there this ending? There's a sense of, does Christ return at the end of the book? But you're obviously reading it in the period before the return. You get this sense at the ending, where the final words are, even so, come Lord Jesus. So Jesus, in a sense, hasn't returned even when we get to the end of the book. And what comes after that?
Yeah.
Is it the sort of stereotypical Victorian view of heaven? Is it a post-millennial world where we're all working to do something? But you see it in talking about endings. I think you see it in fandom as well. There's simultaneously a desire for a clear narrative ending, but there's a fear of the thing ending itself. So for example, another one of the fandoms that I write about, which is My Little Pony fandom, that show's coming to an end in about a month and a half. And I was just at the big American convention for that, which was the final convention, so 11,000 people. So there's a sense in which the fandom itself is coming to an end, and there's a sense, I guess what I got out of that convention was there was a sense of closure, because this had been a big part of people's lives for 10 years or so, and a lot of these people had grown up with this, now had kids of their own, and were introducing them to this. But there's also a fear that this had been a big part of your life, so what comes next? And you see that historically as well. You look at the end of Star Trek, you look at the end of the classic series of Doctor Who, and you look at the fan campaigns to stop those things ending, whether that's writing to the network for Star Trek fans, or I don't know if you remember this, the campaign to stop the cancellation of Doctor Who in 1985, or the Doctor Who hiatus, where they released the world's worst charity single.
Oh, good heavens.
Oh, yeah, look this up. It's called Doctor in Distress, and it attempts to tell the whole story of Doctor Who's history, with being sung by the cast and crew, over a 1980s pop song. Hans Zimmer, bizarrely, is playing the keyboard on this. But it's dreadful. It's
well. You could be an incentive to hunt it down. But because I do remember the Doctor and the TARDIS in 1988.
Oh yes,
with that weird juxtaposition of Gary Glitter and Doctor Who. Yeah.
And in fact, if we're talking Doctor Who, Pop John Pertwee's "I Am the Doctor" from the from 1973 or 1974, yeah. which I think got to number one, or it did, at least did okay in the charts. But yeah, these fan campaigns to stop the endings of these things. So there's always a tension in fandom between wanting the story to continue, but wanting those neat narrative endings. Yeah. And of course, that's where fan fiction comes in. Yeah. Where you can give your characters the ending that they deserved.
Yeah. And actually just put me in mind as well of something that I think I quoted in various undergraduate essays, and even I'm sure the PhD it appears in, which was a source. I found it actually in the Lambeth Library from, I think it was 1920. I think it was Strachan was the author, and the quote was to do with the Parousia, and it was believers were dying and he had not come. I thought it was the best soundbite. It summed it up so perfectly in just half a dozen or so words. But that sort of notion of what therefore do we do? Well, it hasn't come, so how do we respond? And in a way, that's the question of the ages, not necessarily in terms of the Christian apocalypse, but what do you do in terms of dealing with this something that you need and want to happen, but the failure to happen. You know, some people it might be a divorce, some people it might be, you know, even doing a degree sometimes. You know, you have this end goal, but there's a process towards that end goal. So how you feel that time, you can seize the day, or you can sort of drop out a bit and as a result find the whole experience to be, you know, to be wanting.
Yeah. And in thinking in terms of these disappointments, these failures, I mean that is the history of apocalypticism. That I always say to students in the first week of the apocalypse course, that this is a history of people who've been wrong and have been conclusively wrong. We can't argue in that. We can argue about different religious claims of Jesus or the Prophet Muhammad or whatever. You can never have a definite answer on whether these people are right or wrong outside of a theological context and a personal belief context. You can have a decisive answer if someone's predicted the world was going to end last week. It hasn't ended. That person was wrong. So why are we even studying these truths? Why are we thinking about them? And of course, as you say, that it's dealing with that failure.
Yeah.
And most people, when they see a failed prophecy, they think, well, that's it, the Greek's just going to collapse and there's no scaffolding there to deal with that. Yeah. But it's very rare for a Greek to collapse in the aftermath of a failed prophecy. Yeah. And I guess this is where we come into cognitive dissonance and how we deal with these sort of things in our own lives as well. And
absolutely.
The apocalypse on a small scale.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you see that in these films as well, Independence Day and all the other apocalyptic films, where they look at there's the macro level and the micro level, and it's always about there's always a hero and there's a family and there's a dog in many cases. You see it with that film. I think you had it in the one with Pierce Brosnan with the Dante's Peak. But there's all, you know, an animal. There's a whole sort of set of very relatable personal circumstances while the world is ending all around them, and it's that story that's you know the bit that's relatable rather than the scientific concept of the end, which is more about perhaps an idea rather than necessarily a relatable human concept.
And that's hard to communicate on screen as well. Yeah. The absolute end of everything. Yeah. I mean, how do you get that across in any sort of way that's interesting? I guess Melancholia would perhaps be one of the more successful attempts to actually communicate that sense of ending. Apocalyptic films are a whole other subject. Very interesting.
Dogs.
I don't know if anyone's looked at dogs in apocalyptic films, but because there was one in Independence Day as well, I think. Definitely. You need something to relate to. You need some kind of hook, and it's quite difficult if you're using religious apocalypse to necessarily find that. And I think that's why a lot of people find these groups that are based around apocalyptic texts so alien, because they don't have that hook themselves. There needs to be some kind of personal connection, and I'm certainly finding, I found over the last 10 years, the there has been a decline in religious literacy, and that makes it harder to teach religious history in general, and particularly apocalyptic history. Of course, what counters that is the group is the rise of groups like the so-called Islamic State, and awareness there that while most Western students really struggle to comprehend the idea that someone will die for what they believe in, they can now see examples of this taking place, and the fact that these apocalyptic beliefs do have real world actions. And I should say that's obviously a very negative action. Most cases the actions are nowhere near that negative.
Would you say, Andy, that you've fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young? I mean, it sounds like you're doing all this amazing research. Would your teenage self have believed that you were doing all the things that you're doing now, or you know, would you think, yes, this was my ambition?
I don't know. I think my teenage self would probably be slightly surprised that I just admitted going to My Little Pony convention. that wasn't on my dream list. I think I didn't want to be an academic when I was a teenager. I think I wanted probably to be an author or a screenwriter or something like that. But this... I always loved history, and I always loved writing. So the fact that I'm doing this, I think that would please my my teenage self. But then, I know that as you know, we change a lot as we grow older, and I wasn't a Christian when I was a teenager, or until I was 17. So that changed my perspective a lot, and having my sister die when I was in my early 20s or when I was 19, that changed my perspective a lot as well. So I think those two events really coloured everything else, and have coloured my adult life, and so they have influenced the career paths I've gone down and the personal decisions I've made. So that's but I think my teenage self would be I was going to say pleased that I'd written about Doctor Who, but I think I was going through a stage when I was a teenager where I thought Doctor Who was very uncool.
And how that has changed, absolutely. Because when I was involved in the Doctor Who Society at Lampeter, it was kind of, because it was, Doctor Who wasn't being made at that point in the early 90s, and then it came out with a vengeance in the early 2000s.
And it absolutely, I think it shocked everyone how suddenly it was acceptable to be a Doctor Who fan. I mean, but that's, if we're thinking about fandom again for a second, that's something which has changed massively in the last 10, 15 years. That now, when I was growing up, if you were a fan of Star Trek, or if you were a fantasy novel fan, or Lord of the Rings, or what have you, you were very, very nerdy, and you were definitely on the fringes of acceptability. Now fandom is absolutely mainstream, and it's very rare for students to not admit to being a fan of something like Star Trek or Doctor Who or Stranger Things or the Marvel movies. Things which are very, very geeky and nerdy have now become absolutely mainstream.
Absolutely, and with social media as well, you can find those groups. Otherwise, you sort of feel, well, I'm the only person on the street who likes this sort of thing, and therefore there's something aberrant about me.
And it's fine too. I mean, you go down the street, you see people wearing Iron Man tops or Captain America tops or all kinds of things, and it's just a normal part of popular culture now. So fandom has definitely exploded, and that sense of shame of being a fan of something, I think, has definitely decreased, though within fandoms there are hierarchies.
Absolutely, I was going to say, and the Doctor Who then and the Doctor Who now are very different in many ways. Very, you know, the analogue and the digital worlds almost.
Completely. Yeah. But then Doctor Who in 1984 is very different from Doctor Who in 1965.
Absolutely.
So I think that's one of the interesting things where you have these super long running shows, and really, in terms of that longevity, I know I keep mentioning them in this interview, but Doctor Who and Star Trek are the only two which have, comic books as well, actually, you have that sort of long running continuity. Yeah. So you can look at different eras, and I think one of the things that I quite like about fandom, when at its more positive, is it accepts fans who jump in at different eras, yeah, and have different entry points. Though obviously within fandoms you still have fans who say, well, if you like the Next Generation, and you weren't involved in the original Star Trek, then you're not a real fan. And the same sort of the classic break between literary science fiction fandom and filmic or television science fiction fandom.
There's no homogeneity.
No.
And nor should there be. Yeah,
exactly.
And my very very last question, Andy: are you a looking back or a looking forward type of person?
I guess the apocalyptic thing means I do both simultaneously. I think I do spend a lot of time looking back, obviously, historically, and on a personal level as well, sort of analysing. And I think that's quite common for academics, that you tend to be an over-analyser to some degree. And at the same time, I hope I look forward. I guess that's the one positive thing I sort of take from the apocalyptic side, that you are looking for ultimately a more positive future, and however you want to interpret that, that the apocalyptic hope at its root is, we like to talk about the destruction and the big explosions, etc., but at its root it's a hope that God's rule will reign in the world, that justice will come in the world, and that is something that I look forward to, and that's something I hope for. It's not something I necessarily see in the world around me, and also I take that approach with my work with fandom and thinking about say Doctor Who. I mean, right, as we're doing this interview now, there's a huge amount of negativity on social media about the current series, and well, I mean, they're a bit, you can criticise and you can like different eras more than others, but I think being involved in a fandom of whatever it is, you also look forward to what's coming and try to have some positivity towards it.
And this has been such a wide ranging interview. We've covered huge ground. Literally, the apocalypse has come into this as a as a character. This has been riveting. But Andy, thank you so much for inviting me here to Manchester.
Well, thank you, Chris. Yeah. Thanks.